On the line with me now is Ukrainian-Canadian author Marcia Skripik to talk about one of her most recent books, because she has several out in the recent past. This one is called Making Bombs for Hitler. It is about a Ukrainian child who got caught up in the Nazi trap during World War II. And Marcia's here to tell us about her story and the process and all about her book, Making Bombs for Hitler. Marcia, thanks so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you and your listeners, Paula.
Now, Marcia, Making Bombs for Hitler is one is which book now? You've got so many out. What do you have a number on this book?
I think it's number 15. I'm not very good at arithmetic, but I'm pretty sure it's number 15.
Right, you're a words person, not a numbers person, right?
That's right.
So I've just read this book while I was away on vacation, and it's an amazing book. All your books are amazing, but this one I was speechless. I mean, I couldn't put it down. It's not an easy topic to read about, and you said that it was one of the hardest for you to write.
It was very difficult to write. Yes,
wow.
Hard to write about something like this about a really young girl. I mean, she wasn't even 9 years old when she was stolen from her family. And she's lost her entire family. Her mother was killed for trying to help save Jews, and her father was killed for the Soviets. And her sister is taken away, and the two girls are separated. And her younger sister was the subject of Stolen Child, which came out in 2010. And so this story is about the older girl, Lita, but still she's not that old. And most of the children who were stolen like that from their families in World War II, and many millions were taken from Poland and Ukraine, many of them were used for medical experiments or just sent directly to death camps. And this girl decided that she was going to try to make herself useful so that she could live. And this is what she did. And initially, the way that she made herself useful was she demonstrated that she was able to sew. And so she was assigned to work in a laundry for the Nazis. And she did that for quite a while, but it was her own good nature that became her downfall too. You know, her own generosity ended up giving her a worse job after that, as you know, because you read the book.
Mm-hmm. What prompted you to write this story?
I've always wanted to write about the slave laborers. The Osterbeiters, as they were known, and they were the Eastern workers. And it's something that has not been represented in literature at all. I mean, even in terms of personal memoirs, there are virtually none of them. And the reason is because so many of the Osterbeiters, the Eastern workers, died. They did not survive. And if you don't survive, then you can't tell your story.
Right.
So it's this huge hidden story. And, you know, I think it's bad enough to be killed for your nationality, but it's even worse to be killed and then no one cares, no one knows. And so I felt a personal responsibility to tell this story. And it's only been since the fall of the Soviet Union that people have felt comfortable enough who survived this to come forward, because, of course, there's a lot of misunderstanding. After the war, anyone who had worked for the Nazis the Soviets considered them Nazis. So if you were captured from your family and shoved into a boxcar and fed nothing but turnip soup and bread made out of sawdust, and then at the end of the war, if you were liberated, and then the Soviets considered you a Nazi. And so they repatriated millions of these people and either executed them as soon as they got them or sent them to quote-unquote re-education camps, which were Soviet concentration camps.
Good.
Where many more people died, and then if they didn't die, then they were brainwashed and thinking that they had indeed been Nazis, which they weren't. So even people who had, the few who had been able to escape to North America after all that, the only way that they could get here if they had been slave laborers would be to lie from where they came from, because if they had been previous Soviet citizens, then they would be obliged to be repatriated because of the Yalta Agreement. So the only way that they could actually have freedom would be to lie where they came from. So then, you know, the fact that they lied, then they could be labeled a Nazi war criminal, right?
Right. Right.
So these poor people who all that they did was happen to be born in the wrong place between two dictatorships, and, you know, the labels that get thrown around and the racism and everything else. And so how could I not tell the story of these innocent people who have been caught up in the web of the most evil empires of the 20th century?
How? Now, these are really obscure stories, Marcia. I mean, who heard the word Osterbiter, Lebensborn, all of these terms I heard first from you. I didn't know about these things. I mean, I'm born in Canada. I'm second generation Canadian. My grandparents came over at the turn of the century when your grandfather came over.
Well,
right?
Same as me,
yeah. And so all of my relatives came over then over 100 years ago. So I'm Canadian, really, although, I mean, in my heart, I've got great affection for my ancestral roots, which is why I'm doing Nash Holos and have written on Ukrainian topics as well, like you. But No, these terms, Osterbiter, Lebensborn, I'm as ignorant as the next North American about what went on in World War II. And,
well, so was I. I didn't know any of this. And when I choose a topic to write about, it's not because I know about it, it's because I don't know about it. Mm-hmm. I don't see the point in writing about something that I already know. I'd like to write about things that I want to find out about. I want to find out about those little bits of history that have been shoved under the carpet because they're politically uncomfortable for some people. If someone is hiding something, I want to know what it is and why.
Well, you have a good
and
way.
And then I write a book about it.
Yeah, you sure do. Now, this one, the title, Making Bombs for Hitler, is very intriguing to me. I read a review recently that said it might be off-putting for some people. Have you found that that's a problem?
Well, in fact, yes, I have. And the people who find it most objectionable are Ukrainians.
Really?
Yes, because say, well, why would we want to have any part of a book that's called that? Because we don't want, you know, we hated Hitler. And but I mean, I think that it is such an in-face title that it makes people want to pick up the book. And I didn't know what to call this book. I had all sorts of different really lame titles for it. And a friend of mine who is a brilliant writer, her name is Kate Coombs, COOMBS, and she's a poet and a children's writer in the U.S. She came up with this name for me, and I think it's just brilliant because it just says everything. I mean, making bombs for Hitler? Well, how would someone get into that situation? Like, Obviously no one would want to be doing that.
Exactly.
But, you know, and so I, from kids, they're just totally mesmerized by the title. And I did a signing at the Ontario Library Association Super Conference the day after the book came out. And I had the signing was supposed to be an hour long. It was 2.5 hours long. So I think that, and a lot of it was because of the buzz, because people were so curious about what the book could possibly be about.
Now,
because it is a topic that people don't know about.
Yeah. Now, it is a novel, but it's not an adult novel. It is, you mentioned kids just now, so it is a young adult novel aimed at what age group?
It's not a young adult novel. It's a children's novel.
It is a children's novel, okay.
It's a children's novel. I know that it's a really serious subject, but, you know, the thing is some subjects are so serious they can only be dealt with in children's fiction. That's a quote from Philip Pullman, wrote his Dark Materials trilogy, which is just brilliant. But it's true. There are some subjects that are so serious they can only be written in children's fiction.
Yeah, that's well said, because that is really the only way I think I could have read about this topic. I've read about the Holocaust, I've read about Holodomor, and I think I've reached a point with, what is it called, compassion fatigue. It's not that I don't feel compassion, it's just I can't go there anymore. It's just too disheartening, it's too depressing. And
well, the thing about children's literature is when you write a book and it's marketed for children, the ending will be uplifting by definition, pretty much. And that's not true of other genres at all. And for me, I don't like to write about victims. I will never write about a victim. I will write about someone who has stepped beyond that, who has transcended their circumstances.
Yeah.
I will also never write about someone being victimized and use that for titillation and pleasure. And that's the problem with adult literature, is that oftentimes these horrifying things are written in such a way to be light entertainment for adults. I'm not interested in that. What I want to do is to make my readers step inside the shoes or shoelessness of my character and to feel what it was like to be in that situation, because that's the only way that you can break away intolerance. There's no other genre that can do that. And even young adult fiction, oftentimes young adult fiction will have a dark ending, mm-hmm. but children's fiction does not. So that's why this had to be a children's novel, no other kind of novel. And if you think of the book, if you can think of the one book that had the most impact on you in your entire life, most people will choose a children's novel, whether it be Anne Frank or whether it be Black Beauty. It could be Little Women. It could be Oliver Twist. But it will always be something that is essentially a children's novel. Those are the ones that hit you in the gut and stay with you for the rest of your life and actually change the way you think about the world.
Yeah, yeah, you're so right. You mentioned shoes or not shoes, and that's because,
yes.
of course, people in concentration camps, prisoners there, most of them were barefoot, even in winter.
Well, and this was the interesting thing, too, because I had read a number of memoirs. And there would be, people with wooden clogs and various things on their feet. But then I did find a woman who was a slave laborer for 4 years, and it's who I dedicated the book to. Her name is Amelia. And she was actually from Western Ukraine, so she was treated better than the Osterbiters. She didn't even have to wear a label, you know. But she was a slave laborer for 4 years. And during those 4 years, she did not have shoes. And I said to her, but I've read memoirs and these people have had clogs. And she looked at me with such utter despair, and she said, I would have loved to have a pair of shoes. She said, but I didn't for 4 years. And so I felt that if she didn't and she was from Western Ukraine, how could I put a pair of shoes on a character from Eastern Ukraine who is treated even worse?
Yeah.
And Amelia herself, she's almost 90, and she can barely walk, because if you don't wear shoes for that length of time and you're in a Bavarian winter, you don't do well. I mean, you get all infections and everything else. And so to this day, she has been subjected to ongoing pain of what she, you know, suffered as a teenager.
Yeah.
And so as a tribute to her, I had to recreate what she was gone through. And my editor, I have to say, was really upset by that. She said, surely she would have had shoes. Put rags on her feet, something. And I said, but it wouldn't have been accurate. And so if you noticed, as you were reading the book, the character even goes through various things that
yeah.
she might cover up her feet, but it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't work in those circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, she finally does get shoes. But, you know, it's in a pretty gruesome way, and I don't, you know, I'll let the reader find out that way.
Yeah.
But again, it's the way that someone would get shoes in the circumstances. It's not like there was a shopping mall down the street.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Yeah, very gripping novel. I'm curious about the picture on the cover, the little girl.
Well, you know, that picture and the cover itself was Scholastic designed that, and I didn't even see it until it was in the catalog. But the thing that is amazing about it is that girl looks just like my niece, Nicole. It could be her school picture. It looks so much like her.
Well, I looked at it and I thought, I wondered if it was yours, actually, because it could have been.
Well, it looks like me when I was a child as well. But
yeah.
it really looks like Nicole. I just, even where the part in her hair is, everything. Absolutely stunning when I saw it.
Must have sent shivers up your back.
It did, because, you know, you think of your own children, children that you know, children that you love, and you think of them having to go through these things that Lida had to go through in this novel. You don't want to think of that. It's bad enough for an adult to have to go through it.
Yeah, my heart was breaking as I read it, but yet it was an inspiring story because she was so driven by hope, by the will to survive and the will to find her sister and then the determination through all that. She kept holding on to that.
The other thing, too, is that her mother had always taught her that there was beauty in every situation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's something that my mother have taught me. You know, my mom has this phrase that she will use again and again, and it'll be the worst situation possible. And she would say, well, the good thing about that is.
Wow.
And my mother can always find a good thing about it. And I just felt that that was something that my Lida needed, is this feeling of hope that there's always going to be something that she can find hopeful about whatever situation. And I think that for anyone to survive what she survived, she had to feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor, who said that, essentially said that, you know, they take away everything except how your reaction. That's the only thing you can control. The only thing that they can't take from you is your your choice how to view your situation and your frame of mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this book, Making Bombs for Hitler, is a companion novel to Stolen Child, not a sequel. Explain the difference.
Okay, well, the difference between a companion novel and a sequel is, with a sequel, you have to read them in order, and you'd really need to read number one before you could read number two.
Okay.
But these two novels, you can read in either order, and you can read one or the other or both. And, like, all that will happen is that if you read them both, you'll get a fuller story. But you can read Making Bombs first and not be... and still be able to read Stolen Child after. Like, it doesn't give away anything.
Mm.
And it's better to have them separate like that, because the problem with sequels is that for each sequel, it's only the people who have read the one before it that will read the next one, and not even all of them will. So it's sort of like this diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
But if you write a companion novel, then it doubles it as opposed to diminishes it. Do you see what I mean?
That was what I found when I was reading it, because in the back, I had read Stolen Child, and in the back of my mind was always that, because I knew what happened to her sister, and so it I felt more engaged reading it. I think somebody then who read Making Bombs first, and then they read Stolen Child after, would have that same experience, that same feeling when they read Stolen Child. So is this a new concept, a new publishing concept, or is this...
No, actually, pretty much every book I write has been like that. Like, I wrote five individual novels set during and after the Armenian Genocide, and all of them are companions to the others, but they're not, but they're also standalones.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, just as an example, the very first one was The Hunger.
Right.
And it was published in 1999, and it was a time travel. And there is one portion of it that was set during the Armenian Genocide. And then the one after that was Nobody's Child, and it was completely set during the Armenian Genocide with the same characters as that first one, but nothing to do with the contemporary one at all.
Right.
You could read the one or the other, and they just complement each other and enhance. But you don't have to read one or the other to get... like, to be able to appreciate the one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, with the third in that series, Daughter of War, I even switched publishers.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, that's how enclosed they are and how self-contained they are. And then with Call Me Aram and Aram's Choice, those were done as chapter books.
Mm-hmm.
So not young adult novels, but chapter books with illustrations. Yet again, if you read those after reading the other three, you'd get a fuller idea of, like, the entire group that had come over.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also read them individually.
Right, yeah. Except if you do that, and you know that there are companion novels out there, you're not going to just read one.
No, people tend to, no matter which one they start with, then they want to read more.
Yeah.
And that's great. I love to do that because, like, for me, once an era is in my head and I've done all that research, like, it takes me a good 5 years to do the research for any given novel.
Wow.
And I'm not, like, 100 years old and I've written, like, you know, 15, right?
Yeah.
So if I can have more than one novel in the same era, it helps. I still have to do a lot of research, but I don't have to start from square one.
Right. Right. Now, your recent book, just before we started the interview, said you were working on a sequel or perhaps companion novel to your most recent book called Airlift, which is a little bit different. It's sort of got a Ukrainian connection, but it's not really necessarily a Ukrainian theme.
Well, that one is called Last Airlift, A Vietnamese Orphan's Rescue from War.
Mm-hmm.
And the orphan in question, her name is Tu Yet, and she's now married to a Ukrainian, so her last name is Yushchishin.
Oh, wow.
But this is her story when she was 8 years old, and it takes place in 1975 when she was in the last rescue airlift, which is also known as baby lift, from Saigon. And she came to my hometown of Brantford, Ontario, and she actually went to the same school that my son went to, and her kids now go to that same school, and I used to live around the corner from her, but I didn't know her until I was trying to find the oldest orphan on that flight, and she just happened to be that one, and then
wow.
we had all the personal connections like that. So the book that I'm writing after that, I guess it could be a sequel, but again, I'm writing it in a way that is a standalone as well, but it's chronologically the sequel to this book, because she came to Canada as an 8-year-old orphan with who had suffered polio, so she had one leg that didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so the first story is about her rescue and how she didn't know that she was going to be adopted. She thought she was being brought over basically as a child servant. And so her whole understanding of what a family is and that she's like being loved for yourself, not for being able to perform tasks. And so that's what that first book was about. And also, like, you know, just the shock and the scariness of being whisked away from the only home that you've known and flying to a different one. But this new book is about once she gets here, the very first thing that her adoptive parents have to do is arrange surgery on her leg because she's already 8 years old and there's only a limited amount of time that you can do any kind of recovery or anything so that she could walk, actually, right, with her leg. And so her biggest fear before was that she would be taken to the hospital and have her leg cut open. So she's here, and then within a couple of weeks of getting here, she has to confront her biggest fears and not speak the language.
Wow.
So it's about her first few months here and, you know, the way that she is able to deal with it. And it took a tremendous amount of bravery on her part and also compassion on her parents' part to be able to get her what she needed, even though they didn't speak the same language. So I just finished writing the first draft of that on Friday. So I'm doing the revisions of it right now.
Wow. Is it a true story then, or is it a novel?
Yes, it is. It's my first nonfiction.
Oh, wow.
So it's called Narrative Nonfiction.
Ah.
So it reads like a novel, but
mm-hmm.
every single thing is true.
Wow.
And so it makes it in some ways harder, in some ways easier. Like you can't pull truths from this person and that person and create a character. The character is already living and walking. So
right.
everything that is in that has to be true to that character. But, you know, the thing is that this particular girl has blocked out a lot of her memories. And so what I had to do with both books is still interview other people about what happened and then write it from her point of view. And then so what I'm doing this week is I'm reading the entire thing to her, like sentence by sentence, as I sit in front of her with my laptop, because I find that by doing that, after I've researched it other ways, then she can tell me what I've got wrong. But she can't remember it on her own.
Oh, really? Wow. Wow.
It's because, like, you know, it's a very traumatic time.
Yeah, 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 yeah. A lot of trauma. You've taken these really, really troubling times of you know, people suffering, and you've managed, in the words of one reviewer, to use take horrific topics in history, but depict them in a gentle and illuminating way.
Well, I mean, what they're living through is still horrific. But it's how, it's the reaction of the people who are living through it that is illuminating. And basically, I think what I always try to do is to make the reader feel that they're that person.
Yeah, yeah.
And by doing that, then they have more sensitivity when they meet people like this. Just as an example to Yed, who I'm writing this book about now, I mean, in the 1970s, there were not a lot of visible minority immigrants in Canada. So you might see this little girl who's got a limp or is walking on crutches or whatever, and she looked, you know, people would think she was Chinese, right? They might not even necessarily know what Vietnamese meant, especially
mm-hmm.
a child.
Mm-hmm.
So they would look away and think again. They'd simply look away.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm doing is forcing the person not only to look right directly at her, but to feel like it would be to be that girl and to have all those challenges and to realize the sheer bravery, the sheer gut and will and strength of character that Tuyette had to get through what she had to do. And the same thing with Buddha. You know, it's instead of looking at them from a distance and judging, you're stepping inside and stepping and walking in their shoes for a little bit. You know, in the one case, it's no shoes. In the other case, in Tuyette's shoes, it's one shoe and then one foot, not even touching the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you can do that, then it just makes people more tolerant of differences and also appreciative of what they have, but also, you know, really thankful that they were able to walk in someone else's shoes for a while, because then they understand that person a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly that's how I felt in reading Making Bombs for Hitler, and I'm very much looking forward to reading The Last Airlift. It's very inspiring, despite the sadness and my heart breaking for this little girl who was captured by the Nazis at age 8, and I think she was 11 when she was finally freed and able to I'm not going to give away the ending. But
bad Paula.
Sorry. You know, hopefully that'll entice listeners to get a copy of the book and all of the books, actually, because they're pretty much intertwined. I mean, all your books, one way or another, they are intertwined, and they are all uplifting and inspiring. And even though some of them are children's books, like you say, picture books, and then this one, which is a children's novel, but still, for adults, it's a lot easier to read a children's book. It's not juvenile by any means. The writing style is great. I didn't feel in the least that I'm reading, you know, something from like a kid's textbook or something from grade 4.
Well, the readership for children's novels is probably about 50% adult in any case. Like, just because it's something as old as children's literature doesn't mean that that's the people who read it. You know, there's huge numbers of adults who read children's literature, and the reason is they know that quality is going to be there. And a lot of adult fiction, it's like, you know, you've got your literary fiction, and then you've got your commercial fiction. And a lot of the commercial fiction is written pretty much to throw away.
Yeah.
And so if someone wants to read something that is, they can read in a night or two, but is not throwaway literature, then they're much better off reading a children's book, because it will stick to them for the rest of their lives in many cases. But it's not going to take a huge time commitment. I prefer to read children's books myself for that reason, because like they're just so meaningful, but also short. And also, like adult fiction, a lot of times will have many intertwining stories, especially if you get something that's historical fiction, which is what I really like.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're reading a 1,000-page book, right? That's a lot of a commitment. And if you're traveling or something, that's a big thing to carry around.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're reading historical fiction that's geared towards children, you can read one and you can, like, set it aside and pick up another one. It's a different format, and hits you in a different part of the brain. I guess, like, you look at commercial fiction for adults more as candy, whereas you know, this is meatier.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there was so much that I learned here, and I was able to go back in time. Whereas with an adult fiction novel, sure, that'll take you back in time, but it's a lot. You don't remember a lot of the details. Certainly after reading your books, this one and Stolen Child, I consider myself, just from reading these rather than doing the amount of research that you did, that I know a lot more certainly than when I started out, and a lot more than people that haven't read those books.
The other thing, too, is that when, like, say, for example, if I had decided to write this novel as adult fiction, I would have left a lot of in that people skip over. But when you're writing for kids, you have to be really careful to make sure that every single paragraph is written so tightly. And it takes a lot more time to write short than it does to take long.
Yeah.
But, like, for adults, you know, you might get to page 75 and still not be engaged in the story.
Yeah.
So you can have 75 pages of beginning, right?
Yeah.
But with a kid's book, if you're not gripped by the very first sentence, Mm-hmm. They're put it down.
Yeah.
Like, kids have incredibly honed twit filters.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Well, this is, like I said, a wonderful book, and I recommend to anybody listening to this interview, if you haven't read this book or any of Marcia's books, definitely do start now. This book was Making Bombs for Hitler. It was published by Scholastic, and you can find it, as was Stolen Child. You can find these books and links to them on Marcia's website, which is Kalla.com. That's Kalla as in Lily, C-A-L-L-A. You can also go to the Nashola's website. There will be links there to where you can buy her book and find out more about Marcia and her writings. So thanks again, Marcia, for joining us and telling us about this. And good luck with your next novel. I'm looking forward to them.
Thank you so much, Paulette.